Off-Trail Learning. This is Blake Bowles. Today I have Antonio Beeler on the show, who has done a lot of work with both traditionally educated and non-traditionally educated young people who are going to college, especially competitive colleges, and especially students who have kind of weird gaps in their backgrounds or low GPAs or don't have certain test scores. And so if you are a parent or a young person who is thinking about college in the near future, and if you suspect you might have a fairly non-traditional background, that's what people are going to think when they look at your application, this is a great and a very practical episode for you to listen to. And if college is still a distant possibility or a big question mark, this will also give you a lot of food for thought in terms of looking down the line if colleges, especially more difficult to get into colleges, is something that you think might be a good fit for you or your kid. I had a great time talking to Antonio, and I think you'll enjoy listening to this. So without further ado, my guest today is Antonio Beeler, founder of Abrome Education in Austin, Texas. Antonio, welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've wanted to have you on for a long time, and you are someone I really respect who has written about college admissions for homeschooled, unschooled, alternatively schooled teenagers. But before we talk about that, I want to hear about Abrome and what you're doing, because this is a physical school, or is it an alternative to school that you're running in Austin?
Yeah, we don't use the word school, but, you know, effectively, you know, from the perspective of society, it's a school, but it's a learning center, and we bring people together to engage in self-directed education. We do have certain supports, and we have certain practices and structures that we utilize to try to facilitate self-directed education. But at the end of the day, we treat children as people, we respect them, trust them, and they have the option as to what they choose to engage in. We don't have teachers or classrooms or curriculum.
Got it, unless a kid asks for it.
And if the kids ask for it, then we say, great, how can we do this? We never step into the role of, oh, you want to learn algebra, so therefore we will set up an algebra class for you.
Okay, you sound almost Sudbury-like in your reluctance to impose anything on the kids, even if you think maybe they want it.
Well, we definitely have a lot in common with Sudbury schools. We are eager to share with them what our experiences are and what our feelings are and what our thoughts are. We are happy to facilitate learning. We provide offerings where they can join in. But we try to avoid replicating what happens in schools where they feel that adults are the ones that have the knowledge and the insight, and therefore they need to come to us to sort of fill them up. We rather partner with them to go down a learning journey together so that they never sort of get a mindset that they're helpless and they need to seek out people with expertise or certain titles in order to engage in learning.
Self-directed education purist. How big is Abrome in terms of enrollment, and how long has it been around?
So we're in our third year. We haven't finished our third year yet, and we have 12 learners, and we're desperately hoping to grow because we're still not financially sustainable, and financial sustainability is pretty critical to creating a community wherein every person is fully respected and feels whole. I'm talking particularly about the facilitators in this
yes.
in this regard.
Yes, yeah. I understand. And how old are the learners at Abrome?
Our youngest learner is 4, and our oldest is 15. And our goal is to expand that up to 18.
Okay, great. How did you get into this realm?
Well, that's kind of a long story, and I'll try to keep it as short as possible. I went to the United States Military Academy at West Point because I thought that the only way to go to college was to go to college for free, and West Point's not free. It requires a 5-year active duty service commitment, but when you're a kid, or when I was a kid, I was only thinking of how much it costs in a dollar and cents perspective. I did 5 years in the military. I got out, went to Stanford, got my MBA, went into finance. And while I was in finance, I began looking for companies to buy. the question was, what type of company do I want to buy? It should be something that I love, something that like I'd be happy to do every single day. I always loved working with kids. I said, well, education is the best way to work with kids. And that led me into looking into charter schools and curriculum providers. And after I went to a homeschooling summit, you know, I was like shaken a little because I saw all these kids who were really loving of their siblings and their parents. Mm. And that was just not something I've seen very often. Like there was no kid saying, get away from me, mom. I hate you. You ruined my life. It was a lot of affection between family members.
Yeah.
And the second thing I noticed was that the kids were much more likely to look at me in the eyes instead of like kicking rocks. And they were much more likely to talk to me as a human being and as if they were human beings, sort of mutual respect. And I was just so shocked by this. I'd never seen it. I've worked with kids in so many contexts that I was like, wow, even if the academic outcomes, and at the time that was my focus, even if the academic outcomes are the same, you know, if you just have kids who love their families more and kids who feel like they're members of society or they're equal members of society, you know, that alone becomes a strong argument for homeschooling. Uh-huh. And then so I realized that, you know, I need to, you know, find different ways to help young people with education. I ended up shutting down the fund that I was running. I moved to Austin, Texas, to help people leave traditional schooling and homeschool. And in the process, I just kept running into unschoolers, and I kept, you know, and I started to like read John Holt and, you know, John Terragato, eventually Peter Gray, and then even non, you know, white males. And I came to the realization that schooling, the practices and structure of schooling are the problem, and that even homeschooling, wherein a lot of parents bring school into the home and they maintain a sort of authoritarian approach to raising their kids, whether it's bringing school into the home or bringing church into the home, and I just had a really hard time with that, and I just realized that at the end of the day, you know, education can't be liberatory unless you actually focus on, you know, liberating children from, you know, various forms of authority and oppression. And so I just went down the rabbit hole of self-directed education, and I ended up launching a BROM a few years later because I just felt that was the best way to demonstrate for people that self-directed education was a viable alternative for mm-hmm. them. And the long-term goal for me is to have self-directed education communities everywhere in the world. And once that's available for everyone and people recognize that it's not just an alternative to schooling, but a radically, you know, superior alternative to schooling, you know, then I think that we can tear down you know, coercive forced schools and the next generation or the following generation of people who grow up without that sort of authoritarian, oppressive childhood are the ones who are much more likely to take on the other forms of oppression within our society that I think are so vital to take on.
Wow. Like, this is why you're on my podcast. Well said. Okay, I want to ask you one quick question about Austin, and then let's start talking about college. Mm-hmm. What mixture of these more conventional homeschoolers, the ones who perhaps the kids don't really have a choice in the matter, versus more self-directed learners, more unschoolers, did you find in Texas, and I guess in Austin specifically, which is a very special microcosm of Texas?
Yes. So in Texas, it's overwhelmingly religious homeschoolers that are doing box curriculum of some sort. There's a lot of young earth sort of focused homeschoolers. But in Austin in particular, it's definitely far less you know, religious. There's a much higher percentage of eclectic homeschoolers or unschoolers. I don't know the actual breakdown, but it's... If I run into a homeschooler in Austin, it's much more likely that they're more self-directed than they are sort of doing a curriculum at home.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I remember that Austin has its own alternative education fair every year. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a school fair. It's not necessarily very big, but Austin is pretty unique in that we have a good number of alternative schools, and those schools run from self-directed education spaces such as a Brome and Clearview Sudbury, which is a Sudbury school in town, to sort of progressive schools that have a certain twist to what they're doing, you know, where they don't grade and they don't have homework and they, you know, they treat children more humanely. Mm-hmm. But I think of Austin as kind of a mecca for alternative education, even if it's still a very small minority that are doing self-directed education.
All right. So if you're looking for someplace to move, consider Austin and go check out a Brome while you're there. All right. Before you started your physical school, which is not a school, you were doing college admissions advising. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So when I moved to, I'll take it back. So I did not have preparation for college myself. I was the first one in my family to graduate high school, much less go to college. And so I didn't know anything about the process. I got very fortunate in the process that a teacher sort of tipped me off early on, like, this is something you might want to do. Here are the steps to do it. And then when I was applying to business school, I just knew I wanted to get out of the military and I wanted to go to Stanford. And Stanford had the lowest acceptance rate in the country for business schools. And I knew that the odds were stacked against me because I had a low GPA in college, like a really low GPA in college. and I was like, there has to be a way for me to get in spite of this. And so I started to do a lot of research, you know, first by going to online forums and asking a lot of questions, and then doing lots of reading of like, how do you game the admissions process? And, you know, I only applied to Harvard and Stanford. And once I got in, people just started coming to me, asking me to help them or help their cousin or help their niece or nephew. And so I started doing that for MBA programs, and then I started doing it for colleges. And I just sort of did that on the side as a way to make money and have fun for a while I was doing my other things, you know, in education and otherwise. And I did it through sort of teaching. I taught for 2 years at a progressive school in Austin, and I did it through my time when I went back to Harvard to get my ed degree. And I finally quit that when I started at Brome, just because I didn't want any sort of conflict there.
Mm-hmm. So you were mostly working with traditional students who wanted to go to elite schools like Harvard and Stanford, and you were sharing what you had learned about, as you said, how to game the system, how to get the best admissions possible for the least work. Is that accurate?
Well, unfortunately, I was working with people who were kind of applying in the 11th hour. So people who were applying to business school that fall or who were applying to college that fall. And so there are certainly ways to prepare oneself to get admission. And if you, you know, the earlier you start, the easier it is to line up certain things. But I was usually dealing with people who had some sort of glaring shortcoming or a red flag in their application, and I was helping them to manage around that. And that's why I was able to, you know, charge people money for it, is I was able to like help them. And it was based on, you know, initially my application with my low GPA from college, and then helping other people get in with low standardized test scores or really, you know, weak transcripts, stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see how people would be desperate for your services and maybe pay you a lot of money for an intervention there. Can you give me an example of maybe the typical kind of person who you worked with during your time doing this for money and how you helped them?
Yeah, so the typical person... I'll stick with college admissions because that's more relevant, I think, to what your audience is listening for. The typical person that I helped with was sort of middle class or upper middle class, kids who had good but not great GPAs and SAT or ACT scores, who were involved extracurricularly but didn't really do anything to stand out. And I would be very honest with them in the process. I would say, you know, like right now, you know, based on your numbers and your experiences and your likely recommendations, you could probably get into like a top 150 school or something. And I'm not going to get you into Harvard or Stanford, but I could get you into a top 50 school. And if they could get into a top 50 school, I'd be like, well, you could probably get into a top 15 school. And so I basically said, I can get you in like a tier or two above where you're at, but there's some things that just can't be overcome. And I worked with some families who just couldn't afford it, you know, and they would come and tell me like, hey, this is our situation. You know, so there was one girl, for example, who, you know, was an immigrant. Her mom was an immigrant, I mean, and it was just like a really unfortunate situation at home with the dad who was very unsupportive. And so I decided to take them on pro bono. And I've done that for certain clients, but the majority of the clients were clients who could afford to pay, who quite frankly didn't really need to get into the top colleges because, you know, because of who their parents were and the resources that they had, they were going to do okay anyway. And quite frankly, that's one of the reasons why I really needed to stop this. Not only was it because there was a conflict in actually running a self-directed education center, but it was also, I was working so hard to help, you know, usually children of means game the system to get into these top schools, and they're the ones that need it the least. And then people like me, when I was growing up, whose parents didn't even graduate high school, you know, I didn't have anyone, you know, for support, and I certainly didn't have anyone who was like showing me how to game the system. And and in many ways, higher education, you know, is just, it reaffirms and amplifies the disparities in our society in spite of all the rhetoric behind it. And it was just something I didn't feel good about.
So a lot of parents, when they come to the world of self-directed education and alternative schools, college is pretty much the big thing that they worry about. Maybe a socialization first for younger kids, but then when they think about continuing into the high school years, it's this giant question mark. You know, how can my kid, especially a kid who goes to a school like yours, like a Brougham or like a Sudbury school or any of these other places where nothing is really asked of them. And so a kid can feasibly just sort of screw around for a number of years and play games or dabble a little bit in many different subjects. And then, you know, as a parent, you are seriously nervous. I've heard this from so many parents who I've talked to. About how this process works of going from such an unconventional, such a self-directed, kind of almost unintuitive educational background into the traditional four-year system. And so I'm curious where the bridge came for you going from a more conventional college admissions advisor who was also aware of alternative education into, well, specifically, I'm thinking about this article that you published, which was a really wonderful article. It's titled College Admissions for Alternative Schooled, Homeschooled, and Unschooled Applicants. And you posted it on the Abrome blog and also on Medium. And it just summarizes everything. Like I failed to see something that you missed here regarding, you know, helping non-traditional students get into colleges, especially very competitive colleges like the Ivy Leagues. And so I'm curious when this overlap happened between these two worlds for you and what that looked like.
So you want me to summarize basically, you know, how college admissions works for non-traditional students?
Yes, let's start there.
All right. Yeah, so you know, back in the 80s, homeschooling, in the 70s for sure, but, you know, and then into the 80s, homeschooling was seen as something that was really fringe, you know, really problematic. Colleges were very antagonistic to homeschoolers for a long time, and they were certainly antagonistic towards unschoolers, people who didn't, you know, at least try to replicate school at home. And it wasn't really until the very late 80s that colleges started to, you know, become more comfortable with it. MIT, you know, was one of the leaders. Harvard, you know, early on accepted some kids. Yale accepted some kids. But Stanford was the first one to actually come out with sort of guidelines for their admissions committee on how they would go about evaluating and looking at homeschool students. Mm-hmm. And over time, you know, more schools saw that, one, there's a lot of homeschoolers out there. And, you know, two, they come in and they actually end up doing really well relative to the general population. And they're usually pretty interesting. And so there's very few schools today that have a negative bias towards alternative schooled or self-directed learners. And it's unfortunate that they do. And I think that, you know, they lose out because of it. But the overwhelming majority of colleges and universities, and to include the very selective ones, are either neutral or pro homeschooling and alternative schooling in general. These schools, they want to evaluate their applicants along the measures that matter most to them in building a class, just like they do with the applicants who are applying to who are applying from traditional schools. The thing is because most students who are applying to these schools are applying from traditional schools, public or private, you know, they're all stuck in a system where rigor matters, because they're trying to compare everyone to each other and they want to see who works the hardest and gets the best grades. And sort of individual decision making doesn't matter so much because there's so little time for it. You know, so everyone starts taking the advanced math courses, the advanced science courses. They all get on tracks to get certain, transcripts that look good to the schools, and they all compete amongst themselves to rise to the top. And they do the same with extracurriculars, et cetera, et cetera. And so when they're comparing students who are coming from traditional schools, they use a lot of the things that that the general populace thinks are really important, such as GPA, how rigorous a transcript is, standardized test scores, mm-hmm. as a way of ranking kids, and using those numbers as a proxy for what the school really cares about. The thing with alternative schooled or self-directed learners is that they don't have to play that game. And so they can just get straight to the point with the school in demonstrating what the schools ultimately want. And what the schools ultimately want is they certainly want a certain level of academic potential and preparation, because they don't want anyone to come in and not be able to perform in the classes and do well. And they don't want people who are not going to be able to go on and do, you know, more academic things in the future. So there's that expectation. But what's most important to them, and every school has their own approach to admissions, and they're trying to craft a class based on, you know, what they consider their unique DNA. But at the end of the day, they're looking for things such as diversity. You know, they're looking for things such as, like, how does this person contribute to the culture of our school? And they're looking for things such as intellectual vitality. And that's a word that Stanford University has used. And I feel like it's one of the best words to explain what I try to explain to so many people. Because, and stop me anytime, because I'm kind of like just talking.
Oh, you're doing great. Okay. You are doing great. Keep going.
Because over 50% of the students who get accepted at many of the so-called elite colleges and universities, I'm talking about like the Ivy League schools or the Ivy Plus, which includes like MIT and Stanford and Duke, you know, Chicago, schools like this. Because over 50% of the class that is that they bring together is comprised of children with hooks. You know, they have a situation where a lot of times those children with hooks are still really great candidates, right?
Can you explain what a hook is, Antonio?
Yeah, so a hook is something that gives a student an advantage in the admissions process. And the one that most people want to point out is being an underrepresented minority, you know, being Black or Hispanic or, you know, being indigenous in origin. But so not Asian, not South Asian, not East Asian, definitely not white or Jewish. But that's actually like probably one of the least advantageous sort of hooks that you can have. A much more powerful hook is being a recruited athlete, being a legacy, or having a parent who is a senator or a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, or being the child of faculty. And so those are all hooks. And so like in, at schools like Harvard or Princeton or Yale, over 50% of the class in any given year can be children with hooks. And again, you know, oftentimes these kids are great kids and, you know, they might have gotten in even without the hook. But they have less than 50% of the class just to fill with kids that they're trying to use to shape the culture of the school. And obviously those kids with the hooks have a much higher chance of admission, right? And so they're trying to figure out how do we fill the rest of the class to create what we want to create as an intellectual academic institution. You know, how do we create an environment where people are eager to learn, ask questions, find the answers to questions, create innovative solutions, etc. And Stanford uses this term intellectual vitality as their measure, but different schools have their own terms. But they want to bring in kids who have demonstrated that they have this, you know, thirst for knowledge, this thirst for understanding, this thirst for creating or finding solutions to problems that other people can't find the solutions to or don't even recognize that there's a problem. And so with less than 50% of the class to fill, they really have to find really remarkable people to shape that sort of culture within the student body. And for a kid who goes to a traditional school, who's trying to get into these schools, you know, they're taking all the right courses, they're taking all the right AP tests, they're studying hard for the SAT or ACT, they're doing their mandated service hours, and then they're doing their additional service hours, and they're doing their student body president thing, they're a member of X number of teams, they're captain of the team, they're doing AAU basketball, or they're doing, you know, club tennis or golf. They're doing all these things to position themselves to look really good to the colleges, and the reality is that they have very little time to do anything that's really meaningful for them, and they have very little time to really pursue their own personal and oftentimes intellectual interests or pursuits. Self-directed learners, unschoolers and kids that go to democratic schools or self-directed learning communities, they have a huge advantage in that, you know, 8 to 12 hours of their day isn't already claimed by someone else. They have the opportunity to really pursue what is of interest to them, what they find meaning in. And lo and behold, when people have an opportunity to pursue what they care about and what they find meaning in, they're likely to do it really, really deeply. And with that comes a certain level of mastery and expertise. And if you document that, and you can demonstrate that to the school, you can really stand out in that regard. And I'll go back to Stanford University as an example. You know, I don't know what the case is now, but as of the 90s, you know, they used to rate, well, they still rate students on an intellectual vitality scale. And, you know, the highest rating, at the time, it was a 1 through 5 rating. And it still is a 1 through 5 rating.
Sounds like, but, you do know how it is right now.
You know, I was talking to a former admissions dean at Stanford, you know, who was behind, you know, sort of codifying sort of their approach to dealing with homeschoolers. And intellectual vitality is the one thing that really is the most important. They have institutional sort of objectives or priorities, but at the end of the day, when they're shaping their class, intellectual vitality is the thing you know, if you don't have one of these huge hooks, is the thing that matters most. And if you meet someone from Stanford or from many of these other schools who do not have a hook, and yet they had like a really low GPA in high school, or they had a low standardized test score or something else, you can just assume it's intellectual vitality. The school was so impressed by this person's intellectual vitality that they said, we need to have this person on in spite of the fact that they didn't measure up in one of these other sort of metrics that people, you know, mm-hmm. Judge us by. Mm-hmm. And so what he was telling me, and it was a male admissions director who I was talking to, what he told me was that, you know, it's so rare to top the charts on intellectual vitality. They intentionally make it so that very few people get rated that high because it's really special. But for homeschoolers, and particularly the non, like, the ones who are doing it to liberate their children as opposed to sort of indoctrinate their children, that's the softest way I can put it, they disproportionately, like many times the admissions rate, were able to get that highest rating in intellectual vitality. And so therefore they had a disproportionate acceptance rate. And what people think and what people do is they look at the, you know, incoming class numbers at these schools and they say, oh, less than 1% is homeschooled, you know, but more than 1% of the general population, you know, the general student, Looking pool is homeschooled, so therefore homeschoolers must have a disadvantage. And it's like, yes, homeschoolers have a disadvantage if they're doing a traditional curriculum-based homeschooling regime. Mm. But they have a huge advantage if they are actually able to self-direct and they're actually able to demonstrate intellectual vitality. And it's hard to demonstrate that intellectual vitality unless they're able to choose, you know, how they want to spend their time.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It's this whole balance between risk and reward, I think, from the perspective of a parent. It's the more freedom I give my kid, the higher the possibility that they will really soar. In this case, we're talking about soar academically. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure in their brains, there's also the chance that they'll also crash and that they will not take advantage of this freedom. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've talked with a lot of parents who think, well, maybe my kid just isn't that kid who, given freedom and support for self-direction, will gravitate towards academics. And so don't I need to force them into doing some basic academics? Don't I need to curtail their kind of freedom in order to look out for their long-term best interests so they can go to college, they can get a BA? I mean, when you enter into these kinds of conversations, where do you steer them?
That's a good question. At the end of the day, I mean, there's an opportunity cost to everything. And when we try to fill up their time in an effort to do what's best for them, we're taking away their time to engage in what's meaningful and to find what really motivates them, and to pursue their unique interests. And our conception of what is intellectual is like so narrow. Our as a society, like, we really think everything is about linguistic and mathematical type of areas, and that's such a tiny percentage of what the world has to offer. From an opportunity cost perspective, every time we do that, what we're doing is we're eating up time that they could use otherwise. What we're also doing is we're convincing them that certain types of academics aren't necessarily fun. They're not necessarily something that you would choose on your own. And then we're often giving them a mindset that this, you know, this is just work to be done. You know, this is something I have to slog through, you know, which certainly isn't going to, benefit them in the long term if they're like really driven to, you know, answer questions, about the universe. This sort of getting into college is so easy, right? Your child can play video games for 13 years and still get into college.
Yes, right? Yes. That's the truth.
Yeah, you can go to a local community college, and from a community college, if you do well, you can get into the UC system, right? Like, I mean, or yeah, any
University
other
of
state
California system.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, like I don't know what the number is, but the number used to be something like 25% of the students at in the UC system, the Cal system, were people who were coming from community colleges, and when they graduate from there, it's not like, oh, you graduated from Cal, but you spent your first 2 years in community college. You're a Cal grad, right?
That's right. You got the same diploma.
Yeah, and a woman that I worked with on a project at Harvard, she was a Harvard PhD student, and she came from UCLA, and we were just talking, and she was, poor growing up, this and that, and I found out that she spent her first 2 years at community college and then went to UCLA. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, there's so few people that do that. And she's like, no, a lot of people do that. So there's no GPA requirement to get into a community college. So it's extremely easy to get into college, and even beyond community colleges, most colleges are non-selective. Like, most colleges accept well over 50% of the people who apply to them. There are many schools that accept over 99% of people who apply to them. And so college, if I don't do this to my child won't get into college, is simply a misunderstanding of how of what the college landscape is. Now, if they're saying, if I don't do this to my child won't get into a U.S. News top 20 school, well, okay, that's different. But there's very few people that getting into a U.S. News top 20 school really benefits. And those people disproportionately are going to be the extremely poor and students of color. But if you're a middle-class white family, it doesn't matter where you go to college. It doesn't matter if you go to a top 20 school or a top,
Sure, it doesn't matter as much compared to the more outlier cases.
Right. Well, I would say that it doesn't matter, period. And people have done analyses of these where they've shown, and individuals are very different than averages, right? So every individual has their own individual story. But like, the people who actually benefit when they've had choices between going to one school or going to the local state school, the ones who have benefited, in any sort of significant way were the ones who were coming from the lowest, I believe, decile of the income ladder.
And, yeah, that's right.
And students of color. But for, typically, middle class white students, it doesn't really matter that much. And Michael Spence from Stanford has written about looking at people who got accepted into schools and then went to the state university and looked at them long term, and life is about a lot more than economics. But from an economic standpoint, there wasn't a difference. Now now there's no question that there are certain avenues that are blocked off if you don't go to certain schools. The best example I can give is if you want to become a Supreme Court justice. Like, if you don't go to Harvard or Yale Law School,
luck, buddy.
The odds are stacked against you, but there's only 9 justices, right? So they're
tough job market there.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying, for parents who are concerned about just making sure that their kid can get into any college and get a 4-year degree, they don't need to be that concerned, because most colleges are actually not that selective, and they're not allergic to non-traditional applicants. And we have the community college system. So whether you apply as a junior transfer student or as a regular freshman who happens to be homeschooled or alternatively schooled, there's not this giant institutional barrier that we imagine, this bogeyman that is going to prevent your kid from going to college if they want to.
Right. But here's the kind of kicker, right? Like, in an effort to get their kids into certain schools, or in an effort to prepare their kids to be able to go into these schools and do really well, we subject kids to academically rigorous traditional public or private schools, or we bring in, a lot of forced schooling into a homeschool environment, to sort of make them do well and prep them to get into these schools. It's far better to be at the top of the class at a non-competitive school than to be at the bottom of the class, you know, at an Ivy League school, right? So, you know, what really should matter to these parents is, you know, besides the things that really, really should matter, such as, are your children good human beings? Do they care about other people? Do they care about their
community? How is your relationship with your child?
Right. But beyond that, like, you know, just from a performance perspective, you know, with regards to education, what they should care about more than getting into schools is sort of how are they going to perform when they get to those schools. And the thing is that children are going into colleges burnt out, right? They've had a lack of sleep. They've been overworked. They've been forced to do work that is not meaningful to them and that they don't have deep interest in. And so therefore, they've learned to put their needs second, and they've learned to focus on performance for others. And so a lot of these kids go to these colleges and universities where they're highly ranked or not, and they're burnt out, and they want to take time off, or they want to party. They want to actually experience life that they haven't been able to experience, and they often get lost in their way. What's unique about self-directed educated kids is they are woefully underprepared when it comes to, like, you know, do they know how labs work, right? You know, have they spent many hours, like, doing, you know, like, math sets and stuff like that? And they don't have the language, that their traditional school students have, and they don't have practice taking tests. But lo and behold, they end up doing just fine in these colleges and universities. And they often, you know, from a GPA perspective, they tend to do better. From a graduation rate perspective, they tend to do better. And I haven't researched this, and I haven't found any research that, you know, explains this, but my belief is that they're choosing to go to college. Someone who hasn't been forced to go to school for 13 years, they're typically not being forced to go to college. It's a choice that they are making. And when it's a choice that you make, you're more likely to take it seriously. They're also less burnt out. They haven't been sleep deprived for the past 4 years, for example. And when they engage with sort of academic classes or topics or ideas, they're much more likely to be like, oh, this is novel, this is interesting. And unlike the ones who came from school, they have the freedom to play with it. You know, they're not stuck just a curriculum, but they have office hours, they have additional readings, you know, they have resources of school to dive deeper. And so, you know, my belief is that, you know, because of that freedom that they had prior, you know, they're much more likely to take it seriously and take advantage of the opportunities that are available. And so even with parents who have the best of intentions, you know, I would really encourage them to back off and allow their kids the opportunity to not sort of prepare themselves academically the way that they think they need to be preparing themselves.
Even if that means your kid doesn't start college until age 19 or 20 or 21, or maybe even later as an adult learner. But the point is, if they do it when they're ready for it and they are consciously, consensually choosing this path, you know, as you said, they're going to do much better, most likely, in college. So don't push it.
Yeah, exactly. There was a book that was written. It's called Hillbilly Elegy. And it was really popular about, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And it was just, it was a memoir of this guy who has political aspirations, et cetera. But he was a lower middle class, you know, poor kid whose parents came from Appalachia. You know, he was raised in Ohio, and he went to, into the Marine Corps. And then he just went to Ohio State because, that's the state school, right? And he did so well, but, you know, he went into it, and he just, he found what it was that he wanted to do, and he really enjoyed it. And, you know, fast forward, you know, he ends up going to Yale Law, you know, and, you know, so like that's a success story. Or, you know, Educated by Tara Westover. That was an example of a woman who had an extremely abusive childhood. Mm-hmm. That wasn't unschooling. That was the
worst version of homeschooling.
Right. That was denying her the opportunity to educate herself. But she ends up going to BYU, you know, against the wishes of her parents. And she went there, you know, extremely behind in sort of like academic skills. But she ended up doing fabulously well, and she went, you know, ended up going on to Cambridge, you know, and, you know, so that's an example. Or Todd Rose, you know, the author of End of Average, which I argue every educator should read, self-directed educators should read, you know, and he was a guy who, you know, got his girlfriend and then wife pregnant when he was a teenager. You know, he worked a bunch of minimum wage jobs. You know, he could not get good scores in any test that he took, you know, but he ended up, you know, working his way into community college and like talking his way into honors classes in spite of the fact that he was, you know, he had no right to even go near the honors classes. And then he ends up long term, you know, becoming a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. So he's a professor at Harvard. And like, and these are anecdotes, and I don't mean to argue that you have to, you know, get into elite colleges to be a success story. But like, those are anecdotes that, like, you know, should make it clear to some parents that like this whole notion of my kid has to be ready to get into a certain school at the age of 18, and those schools should be like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, in order for them to reach the highest levels of, you know, success by societal standards, is just nonsense. You know, what we put children through just so they can have that opportunity, you know, is really misguided. But even from the sort of like risk averse perspective, like, okay, maybe my kid won't like lead a great life, but at least, you know, they won't be living, you know, on the curb, right? Like, at least if they get an education, if I force them to get an education, at least they'll be okay. I still think that that's misguided, because if you never give your child the opportunity to make decisions that are relevant in their life, and you tell them that education, college degree is the answer to, you know, not being poor, you know, not being financially secure, you know, what they're going to do is they're not going to really love learning. They're not going to really find what's meaningful in their life. They're going to go to college, and they may or may not graduate with a degree. And then all of a sudden, for the first time in their life, they're actually going to be in charge of their life. And so even if you fear that they're not going to voluntarily learn algebra, or they're not going to voluntarily learn how to write a 5-paragraph essay, you know, while they're, you know, pre-18, you know, releasing the reins and giving them the freedom to figure out what's meaningful to them now, when they have the security of mom and dad, you know, of having a roof overhead, not having to worry about food or healthcare, you know, is still the, what I believe is still the safest path that they can take.
I fundamentally agree with you. And I think it's also a pretty tricky and nuanced subject. And a lot of listeners, a lot of parents who have decided to unschool their kids, for example, probably did come from traditional backgrounds where they were forced to go through the motions. And I bet most of them did go to college. And maybe they look at themselves now and say, well, yes, I was forced to do all this stuff, but I turned out okay. And so maybe, you know, I can give my kid a lot of freedom and still kind of ensure that they get into college, because if I got through it, then my kid can get through it too. And there is a certain bias in our society. Mm-hmm. And the United States is pretty open in terms of this, you know, compared to other countries. Mm-hmm. There is a bias towards people with bachelor's degrees or advanced degrees in the workplace. Anyways, we could talk for a whole nother hour about this subject. But I wanted to circle back to something you were talking about earlier, the intellectual vitality element, and how that is really how homeschoolers and unschoolers and alternative school students stand out, especially with very competitive schools. Can you give me one or two examples of, like, specifically of what an intellectually vital teenager has done, or, you know, what kind of work they've done, how they've you know, showed their skills off to potential schools?
Yeah, that is, every single time someone asks me that question, I refuse to answer it. And I'm not, and I don't mean to, I don't mean to be evasive, but this is the reason why. Every single person is unique in this world. Like, every person is unique relative to the person they were yesterday, quite frankly. But you know, we all learn in our own different ways. We all have our own sort of natural inclinations and proclivities. We all have our own sort of natural advantages in life, and then also the unnatural advantages as well, such as who our parents are, you know, where we live, things like that. And so, you know, what is intellectual vitality to one person, like, you know, that is like a standard, but it's relevant to very, very few people. So I'm not going to give an example, but what I will say is that every single person has unique interests and, you know, experiences that, you know, have helped push them or guide them in some unique way. And when a child has, you know, sort of unbounded time to dive deeply into the things that they care about, you know, they are much more likely to find other sort of activities or, you know, fields that they can dabble in and dive into. And, mm-hmm. and they're able to synthesize and understand things in their area of focus in a way that, you know, over the years, other people just aren't going to be able to do because, you know, other people have a shallow appreciation of our experience with it. And so if they're given the freedom to do something year over year and they're supported in that journey instead of told you're wasting your time, you should be focusing on this, they will, if they want to, they will have the opportunity to create experiences that they can document that will allow you to recognize, wow, this person, you know, pursues something that they care about deeply. They have a deep understanding of it. They can talk about it fluently and they can create something out of it. So intellectual vitality, I can tell you what it's not. Intellectual vitality is not taking a bunch of MIT courses online and saying, look it, I've already done the equivalent of 2 years of, you know, MIT courses, you know, by the end of high school. Intellectual vitality is not sort of, you know, joining science Olympiads and doing really well in competitions against others. Intellectual vitality, what it looks like is it looks like people, you know, pursuing things because there's benefit to them just by doing them. It's not about competing. It's not about being number one.
Let me push back against that for a moment. I feel like there's a distinction to be made here between taking a bunch of MIT courses just to signal your intelligence mm-hmm. to future colleges or doing scientific Olympiads mm-hmm. just to say, look at me, I'm smart, versus doing them as part, you know, if you can fit them into a larger narrative about like, okay, I did this competition because, although in this moment I'm struggling to think of how that fits into a narrative of like becoming a scientist, mm-hmm. but the MIT courses, for example, if this was 2 years of online MIT courses that were related to a specific intellectual passion, then that would definitely benefit the kid, right? If that was made clear in their personal statement, in their admissions package. Do you agree with me?
I agree that it would be supplemental. I agree that it would certainly support a narrative, uh-huh. and the narrative is extremely important. It's like, what story are you telling? Yeah. Very, very important. But if it looks like you're doing something for the sake of signaling, like, look how good I am, look how I can beat out others, look how I'm checking off these boxes, that typically doesn't look like intellectual vitality. What looks like intellectual vitality is getting lost in something because you love it and you don't necessarily have a desire to show the world how great you are. You know, now to the extent that you can then demonstrate it, you know, through like starting an organization, you know, that, you know, you can then point to how much money you've raised or how, you know, many products you've sold, or, you know, because I was involved in this, you know, I ended up doing work with this person and that person, you know, suggested to me that, you know, I, you know, present at a certain conference or that, you know, I compete in this certain competition and then I won. Well, then sure. But these schools have become very good. And again, we're only talking about the super highly selective schools because most other schools, you don't have to do any of this to get in. But the super selective schools, you know, they're very skeptical of people when they're applying, and they're very skeptical of their accomplishments. And, you know, one thing that's common in college admissions committees is like, you know, is this what the dad did? Is this what the mom did? Or is this what the kid did? Is this what the dad wanted? Is this what the mom wanted? Or is this what the kid wanted? And if they see people who are constantly seeking out, you know, some sort of, you know, credential, some sort of ribbon, some sort of award, as a way of signaling intellectual vitality, they're typically not signaling intellectual vitality. But, you know, when you see someone who loves baking, for example, so much, and that baking has led them into, you know, creating their own baked goods line, and that, you know, then leads them to create a YouTube channel, and that, you know, then leads them to, you know, they start doing things not necessarily because they're performing for others. It's like they're so immersed in it that, like, it matters to them. Like are they the kid that's waking up at 4 a.m. to go work at the local bakery for that experience, you know, not knowing that, at, you know, someday in the future they're also going to apply to college, right? You know, like, you know, are they the person who gets so lost in, you know, like, you know, some academic topic, you know, that they develop a deep, reading of whatever, and then, you know, through that they get introduced to a professor, and they work with that professor over a period of many years, and they're doing research in the professor's lab, and they're like co-authoring like journal articles, you know. that's very different than what is happening at a lot of these like highly selective or rigorous like college prep schools, where the kid's a sophomore, and then they're told, now you have to go out and reach out to some college professors and go find a way to work in their lab. You know, so when the college admissions committee reads the one recommendation from the professor or two, they see what the person has actually done in those labs, it's going to be pretty obvious who is just trying to do something to perform for the college admissions committee, and who is like, oh my God, this person lives and breathes, you know, this, you know, topic, and I understand it. And so that's what intellectual vitality is. It's like pornography, right? The Supreme, you know, court, you know, I don't know what it is, but when I see it, I can't tell you what it is, but when I see it, I know what it is, right?
The Supreme Court justice that couldn't give the definition of what hardcore pornography was.
But exactly.
When you know it when you see it.
Right, exactly.
So I'm hearing a theme here, which is a kid going really deep into one thing. And so can you comment on breadth versus depth? If a kid has multiple interests and is not super passionate about one thing and they go really deep into it for multiple years, is that not a good intellectual vitality indicator from a college admissions perspective?
So it depends. Right now, the schools typically want, you know, what they call like T-shaped applicants or sharp applicants, you know, ones that really dive into something. And then they try to create a balanced class or a round class by bringing together all these people with very different unique interests and whatnot to create, you know, a well-rounded class. But it's a traditional school student who would benefit more from like having lots of different interest and whatnot, because like that's what's expected of them because they're forced to do so many different things. But there's, you know, you can demonstrate intellectual vitality by having, you know, multiple interests. And in fact, it's actually easier to demonstrate that if you can, you know, find the overlaps and, you know, find ways to bring different things together. If you're interested in dance and physics, right, like there's ways to bring those two together, you know, that, you know, find the overlap. That's where most of the innovation comes in science, right? It's usually, you know, in at the intersection of two fields. And so, yes, there's certainly a possibility to demonstrate intellectual vitality that way. In fact, you know, that might be a superior way to demonstrate intellectual vitality, but it would have to make sense, right? It couldn't just be, well, I'm interested in these two things, and these two worlds never meet. Right. That then the question is like, well, who are you? What are you trying to do? Why is this important to you? And, you know, critical to the college admissions process for, you know, these sort of elite schools is being able to actually provide a story that allows it to all make sense. And that's where I talk about a common thread with people. It's like, what's the common thread that pulls everything together? And if you can't define that for yourself, you're going to have a really hard time explaining that to a school.
Mm. So, Antonio, for someone who knows so much about the elite college admissions game, I know that you're also very critical of this assumption. You've already expressed this in this podcast, of the necessity and the usefulness or the return on investment of going to highly competitive colleges. And I'm wondering if you can maybe talk about this through the lens of this recent college admissions bribery scandal. Like how did you parse that news? What did that represent to you? And maybe you could give listeners who are not familiar with this just a bit of an overview of what happened.
Yeah, so in short, there was a college admissions consultant who developed relationships with oftentimes coaches at a variety of highly ranked or competitive schools, to include Yale and Stanford and USC. In exchange for those coaches designating his clients as athletic recruits for money, those clients would have an admissions advantage because they would now have a hook.
Yeah, they were buying hooks for tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, and so it was definitely unfortunate, but it was also really fascinating how that became such a big story, because for people who have been in the college admissions world, you know, what this consultant did was he effectively just cut out, this person was acting as like a broker of these opportunities. And so he was enriching himself and the coaches were enriching themselves in a way that the schools were like, or the FBI was like, this is not fair. But it's completely fair if you skip over the admissions consultant and the coaches. Even when the FBI did their press conference initially, it was fascinating. The agent from the FBI said this wasn't an example of parents paying for a new library to get their kids in the school. This was an example of parents paying a consultant, right? And so even the FBI acknowledged that there's ways to buy your way into these top colleges that are completely legal and accepted. And, if you're the child of a rich and powerful person, you have a tremendous advantage. If your parent is willing to pay, $10 million to get you into a school, they're going to let you in. Jared Kushner is, kind of a famous, person, along these like sort of storylines, because in Daniel Golden, I believe that's his name, in his book Price of Admission, he talked about Kushner long before anyone knew that he was going to be, married to the president's daughter. His dad paid something like a measly $1 million or $2 million donation to Harvard.
And he, chump change.
Yeah, and he ended up getting into Harvard. So, like, we've all known that there's ways to buy your way into these colleges, and we've all known that there's ways to have hooks that allow you an end around of the traditional education process. So, for people who have made it their business to be aware of that, it certainly wasn't any surprise at all. But to the general public who tends to believe that college admissions is meritocratic, it was certainly a big surprise.
But what all the news about this controversy made me realize, something I didn't know before or didn't think about, was that, for example, lacrosse as a sport, if colleges are going to actively recruit lacrosse players, they're only going to recruit them from a very small number of high schools where kids have lacrosse. Like, that happens at private schools and definitely more wealthy schools. That's not happening at your run-of-the-mill public school.
Yeah.
And so that this is already happening. Kids are going to private schools to play lacrosse so they can be part of this very small group of people who can then get recruited and circumvent many of the normal academic requirements to play lacrosse for an elite college. And so, like you said, this is already happening, and it sounds like the controversy here was that only moderately wealthy families were kind of exposed for doing this. You know, people who were paying $50,000 to buy a hook for their kids, instead of much wealthier families who are paying millions of dollars to create endowments or professorships or buy new buildings for universities. So it sounds like this wasn't that surprising to you.
Well, what was surprising about it was that, you know, that this college admissions consultant was having them outright lie, and he was getting, he was partnering with coaches to outright lie that these were athletic recruits. And so in that regard, it was surprising and a little bit different. At the end of the day, what the parents should have done is, instead of giving, $50,000 to this consultant, they should have given $5 million to the school, and then they wouldn't have had to lie. Or instead of saying that they were soccer recruit, right, in the 11th grade, they should have actually had the kid training in, some Olympic sport, where the pool is much smaller, so that they could have. The fascinating thing is that, Duke and Stanford, they're Division I schools, and they have to compete, at the highest level. So when you get a basketball player or a football player or a wrestler, those schools, they still have to be really, really good to get in athletically, right, to be an athletic recruit. But when you're talking about some of these Division III schools, like when you're talking about MIT, Williams, Amherst, University of Chicago, you don't even have to be a good athlete. I mean, you have to be good enough to play Division III, but, no one in Division III typically is, setting the world on fire, right? You could be, top, 20,000, football player in high school and play on one of those teams. I don't know if that's right. Maybe top 10,000. But, these aren't the cream of the crop athletically that are getting into these schools, but they have this tremendous, admissions advantage to get into these highly selective colleges and universities. And I just, I think it's good that people are really scrutinizing this case, but I think that they're missing the point, as you said, that there are people who are dabbling in sports and they're not even that good. And these sports have such small pools of people often, that you don't even have to be, good in order to find your way into a school, using this recruited athlete angle.
Well, we're getting near the end here, Antonio, and I want to ask you a few closing questions. The first one is, what are your favorite books regarding college admissions and thinking about the college game that you like to suggest to parents and young people you work with?
Yeah, so, first and foremost, I actually recommend that I do alumni interviews for college admissions, and at the end of every interview, I highly recommend that they pick up Excellent Sheep by William Derisiewicz. I think that is an amazing book for young people, and it's a great way to frame their mind around how they want to take advantage of their college experience, and it helps them think about where they want to spend their time in college. And he makes it very clear that just going to a school like Yale, where he was a professor, isn't doing you or society a favor. The Price of Admissions was an amazing book. It's kind of old now. It probably came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, but it's an amazing book that really explodes the myth of meritocracy with regards to college admissions. So I would definitely recommend people read that if they want to see the hypocrisy of college admissions. With regards to just learning how to game the system, I talk to families about how to approach the college admissions process. And you can do one of two things. You can either play the game or not play the game. And, in the college admissions world, in order to get into these colleges, if you don't have hooks, and even if you do have hooks, it's just to a lesser degree, you have to rise to the top of whatever you're doing, right? You have to rise to the top of your class, you know, in terms of academic performance. You have to rise to the top in terms of your ability on to score high on standardized test scores. You have to rise to the top in, you know, what you do extracurricularly. And so in order to play the game that way, you have to invest tremendous amounts of time and energy to position yourself just to be in play. And of course, you have to write, you know, great essays, you have to get great recommendations, all that stuff. Or you can just not play the game. And that's what I encourage, you know, every young person to do. And I encourage parents to give their kids the freedom to do that. And instead of focusing on getting into these top schools, you know, just focus on doing what you love and doing it, you know, deeply, going into it, you know, whatever it is. And if it's not something that you like, if it's something you realize doesn't work for you, then change course. Like, drop it and go do something else. Figure out to the best of your ability, you know, who you are, what matters to you, and do that deeply. And then when it comes time to apply, you're going to be so interesting. And you're going to be able to demonstrate intellectual vitality, you know, if you're going down this more academic path, that you have a huge advantage in the college admissions process. And if you're looking at schools like Harvard and Stanford and Chicago, et cetera, you're also going to look at, you know, what is expected of me to apply to these schools. And obviously, unfortunately, for all of them except for Chicago, you're still required to submit standardized test scores. So you're still going to have to prepare for those standardized tests, but you're doing it because you want to, and that's a path that you're choosing, and you have ample time to do it, SAT2s as well, stuff like that. But you'll be able to go ahead and build sort of a transcript or a portfolio of experiences whereby you can present it to the school and use it to support the story that you're telling. But most importantly, you're going to be an interesting person that demonstrates intellectual vitality, and that will give you a big advantage in the game. However, there's one huge risk to all of this, is if you're self-directed and you're pursuing things that matter to you because you find value in them, you know, of themselves, then you're much more likely to be the person who recognizes that you don't need to go to Harvard.
That's a real danger right there.
Yep.
And last question for you. You have mentioned transcripts and documentation mm-hmm. a lot, and I have struggled to point parents towards good, clear examples of both of those, often because families tend to keep them private. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do when someone says, okay, but can I see a transcript? You know, how do I document this stuff? I need some concrete examples.
Yeah. So two things. One is if someone is intent on applying to certain schools, like the really selective schools, you know, it probably is a good idea for them to go take a community college course, you know, just so that they can demonstrate that they can sit down in a chair and listen and be in a classroom setting. They don't have to take a bunch, you know, but it helps to take a couple.
And if, completely agree.
Yeah. And so that's one thing. And so that will be an easy way to demonstrate on a transcript that you're doing these things. But the second thing is I would recommend that they not try to replicate a traditional school transcript. So, you know, a lot of unschooling applicants, you know, will go out and say, okay, well, the college insists that I must have 4 years of, you know, math and 3 years of science, including one lab. And so they'll say, okay, this is what I've done over the past 4 years, and this is how I got PE in. This is how I got this in. Those guidelines that those schools provide are for traditional school students who have access to a traditional curriculum. Trying to show that you're able to translate what you did in a self-directed setting so that it somehow would fit into a traditional school setting is actually selling yourself short. And so I do encourage people to create transcripts that are really rich, that talk about what you actually did and why you did it, and not try to create it in a way that looks a certain way, as if you were able to come, as if you came from, say, a small private school. And so, mm-hmm. and these, and these admissions committees in the mid 80s, they didn't have much experience with homeschoolers. Nowadays, they have, X number of homeschoolers apply every year. Many of the colleges have one admissions director who is dedicated to covering homeschoolers plus a certain region.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so, like, homeschoolers are very rarely compared to, like, in some places there might be a representative that is, like, responsible for the entire Southeast, right? But, these schools also typically have an admissions director who says, oh, this is a homeschooling applicant. I'm kicking this over to you because you're looking at all the homeschoolers, as a cohort. And it should be obvious that someone who's self-directed versus someone who's doing a Beck of books at home or some other box curriculum, the unschooler is just going to come out, looking so much better, in the process.
Okay, so it sounds like you don't have any specific places to point people to go see examples of transcripts and documented work. Is that right? I just wanted to follow up.
No,
on
that's
that.
Right. And the stuff that you're going to find online is going to be really terrible because they're going to try to show you how to make the unschooled experience look like you went to a traditional school.
And to be fair, I have talked with people who are applying to, like, maybe less competitive public schools, public colleges that do want the homeschooling stuff to look like traditional school stuff. So that does happen every once in a while. When it comes to more competitive colleges, I'm totally with you in terms of don't restrict yourself by trying to fill in all these bubbles. Write a beautiful narrative transcript that tells the story of what you've done with your life, why you are an intellectually vital person, and then let the evidence flow from there kind of naturally. But I have seen sometimes where they're like, no, just fill in all the boxes. Luckily, that's not too hard to do, right? It takes
right.
a few hours.
Yeah, no, that's very easy. And you're absolutely right. If you're applying to a non-selective college or university, that is the very simple, straightforward way to go. They don't have admissions committees that are diving into these applications, trying to understand the story and trying to figure out the best way to construct a class, because they're tending to accept, most people, and, like, they're bringing on who they can. I'm really talking about these schools that really scrutinize the application, because at the end of the day, they're accepting, less than 20, oftentimes less than 10% of their class. But one piece of advice, though, of course, is that it's so much easier to document as you're going, whether you're doing daily journaling or weekly, like, reviews or whatever, what have I been doing with my time, as opposed to waiting until you're, the summer before you're turning 18 to say, okay, what have I done and how can I put that in some sort of transcript form?
Mm-hmm. And I imagine as a parent, the trick is to do this, to help your kid do this online documentation, or sometimes just do it for them in a way that doesn't put excessive pressure on them to only do stuff or learn stuff that looks academic.
Yeah.
Because I've seen that happen also.
I would encourage parents to just not be involved in the process. So the more that they get involved, the more problems that they often bring up. I encourage all people, to include adults to journal, just like constantly.
I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Antonio, this has been a wonderful conversation. We're really on the same page here, and you are just packed with a wealth of experience and powerful advice. So thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.